equations, I'm going to show you how to construct the solution of the vacuum Einstein equations in one dimension higher. So what got us interested in all this is the idea of holography. From considerations of black hole physics, we expect that any gravitational theory should have a holographic description in terms of a non-gravitational quantum field theory living in one dimension less. So in particular, if gravitational theories are holographic, then one should be able to recover generic features of quantum field theories via gravitational computations. So a generic feature, perhaps one of the most simplest of these generic features, is the existence of a hydrodynamic description that describes the long wavelength behavior near to thermal equilibrium. So your QFT side on long wavelength would have a hydrodynamic description. We'd expect a corresponding description on the gravitational side. So there should be a bulk solution corresponding to the thermal equilibrium state, and there should be nearby solutions describing small fluctuations about this thermal equilibrium state, the hydrodynamic regime. So in the context of ADS-CFT, this picture is beautifully realized. So the thermal equilibrium state corresponds to having a black hole, an ADS black hole in the bulk, and relativistic hydrodynamics is described, you can describe this in terms of a relativistic gradient expansion solution around this black hole background. And solutions describing non-equilibrium configurations, at late times these are well approximated by the hydrodynamic description. And of course there's a very long story of this, many papers, these are just a few. Okay, so today we're going to talk about vacuum Einstein gravity. So in this talk we're going to see that the thermal state can be described by Rindler space-time. And we're going to show how incompressible Navier-Stokes equations and corrections can be described or map on to a non-relativistic gradient expansion of the bulk. And the point of constructing this bulk dual to Navier-Stokes equations is that we're going to be able to use this to learn clues about the properties of the dual fluid. So this provides clues as to a holographic description of flat space-time. Okay, so this talk is going to be based on work done in Amsterdam in collaboration with Jeffrey Compare and also Costa Skenderis and Marika Taylor. And we're also going to be using very closely related work by Strominger, Redberg, Keeler, and Lysov as well. And of course, there's a long history of Navier-Stokes and gravity, some of which is below. So the plan for today's talk is as follows. We're going to start off by discussing equilibrium configurations of the fluid and what the corresponding gravitational description is. And then we're going to go from equilibrium solutions to hydrodynamics by considering small fluctuations around the equilibrium solution. And then I'm going to show you how to construct a solution algorithm that enables you to construct the bulk geometry systematically to all orders in the hydrodynamic expansion. And then we're going to see that this, so we're considering primarily a non-relativistic limit in which time and space scale are differently, but we're going to see that the stress tensor in fact comes from an underlying relativistic fluid. So I'm going to show you how to go from this non-relativistic description back to an underlying relativistic description. And finally, at the end, I'm going to show you a simple Lagrangian model that captures many of the key properties of the dual fluid. Okay, so let's start with Rindler space-time. So if you just take flat space-time and you write it in Rindler coordinates, it has this metric here. Add on to the metric. So the point is, Rindler metric is like this. So just Minkowski space-time, and you can parameterize it via time-like hyperbole, and you've got ingoing null geodesics. So tau parameterizes ingoing null geodesics. So the space-time looks like this. So we're going to be focusing on this portion of the space-time between the future horizon, H+, and this radial constant radius slice, sigma c. So the dual fluid is going to live on this constant radius slice here, sigma c. This is given by R equals RC for a cutoff. Okay, so what are the properties of this space-time? So first of all, the induced metric on this constant radius slice sigma C is just flat. So this is the induced metric here. RC was the location of the cutoff slice, remember. So you can see that RC also has this interpretation as being the speed of light in the dual fluid. For the surface on sigma C, RC is the speed of light. We look at the Brown-York stress tensor. So we look at the Brown-York stress tensor, which is basically, it's the canonical momentum times 2 over root g. So the Brown-York stress tensor, for Rindler spacetime, the Brown-York stress tensor takes a perfect fluid form. So it looks like a perfect fluid where the energy density is 0, but there's a non-zero pressure given by 1 over root rc. And this is a fluid at rest. The four velocity is purely time-like.
In general, speaking, is the surface be weighted in the bowl, or is that just property of it?
No.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is we're going to keep the cutoff location fixed at r equals rc, but we're going to allow the extrinsic curvature to fluctuate. It's essentially a gauge choice, right? The convenient coordinates were going to be ones where we keep the radius of the cutoff slice fixed, and we allow the extrinsic curvature to fluctuate. So that's all, you know, if the extrinsic curvature fluctuates, that produces fluctuations in the stress tensor, which is what we're going to see, you know, which is the hydrodynamics of the dual fluid. Yeah.
How does one define the speed of sound for this fluid?
I suppose you do the usual dp d rho. So this is the speed of light here. This is just as in c squared dt squared.
But if your rho is zero, then you can't express p in terms of
fluid. So it's an incompressible fluid. So
the speed is not anything.
Effectively, yeah. Yeah. So what I'm doing is I'm just trying to engineer an equilibrium configuration. So we start off with Rindler space time, which is just flat space time. We've shown that by writing it in this funny coordinate system and looking at the Brown-York stress tensor on this constant radius slice, then we found that the Brown-York stress tensor looks like a fluid in equilibrium with zero energy density but a non-zero pressure.
Which violates Dom,
probably, but I'm not.
That doesn't work.
No, not at this stage. So, okay. Right. So we just had a fluid with rho equals zero and a certain pressure, and it was in the rest frame of the fluid. The fluid four velocity was purely time-like. So now let's try and generate more general equilibrium configurations with different values of the pressure and with non-zero four velocities. So we can construct these by doing diffeomorphisms. So we start with a Rindler space solution. We do these diffeomorphisms. The point is, there's three things we want to preserve. One is that we want to preserve the induced metric on sigma c. We want to keep it being flat like it was here. We also want to keep the fact that the Brown-York stress tensor has a perfect fluid form. And finally, because we're talking about equilibrium solutions here, we want the bulk metric to remain stationary with respect to the time-like Kinney vector d tau, and we want it to be homogeneous in the spatial directions. You know, the fluid is in equilibrium, so there's no time dependence. It lives on a flat space, so there's no spatial variation. So if you look at all the possible infinitesimal diffeomorphisms, you find there's actually only two that respect all these three properties here. We're interested in infinitesimal diffeomorphisms because we're going to move towards describing hydrodynamics, where the solutions we're interested in are small fluctuations about the equilibrium configurations. Okay, so there are two infinitesimal diffeomorphisms. If you exponentiate these, you find the corresponding finite diffeomorphisms. So the coordinate changes we're interested in, there's basically a constant boost. This is not surprising, right? You want to generate a velocity for the fluid. So there's a boost transformation like this. Remember, root RC is playing the role of the speed of light, so it's like CT goes to gamma CT. And the other coordinate transformation turns out to be a linear shift of the radius and a corresponding rescaling of the time coordinate tau. So this transformation basically shifts the position of the Rindler horizons. The Rindler horizon was at r equals 0, and now it gets shifted to rh. So we start off with Rindler space. We do these two coordinate transformations, and we arrive at a new metric, which looks like this. So this is still just flat space, just written in a different coordinate system. But the point is that in this coordinate system, with this metric here, the induced metric on sigma c is still flat, and also the Brown-York stress tensor on sigma c takes the form of a perfect fluid, but now with a general pressure and a general four velocity. Okay, so this metric describes arbitrary equilibrium configurations. Well, not quite arbitrary, rho is still zero, but we've got arbitrary pressure and we've got arbitrary four velocity for the fluid. In fact, you can show that there's no way of getting a non-zero rho. You know, because we proved that there are only two diffeomorphisms that respect these properties here, there's no way of getting a non-zero rho for the fluid, at least while we hold on to these properties here. If we, in further work, we could consider relaxing these properties, like putting a fluid on a non-flat metric, for example, that might generate a non-zero rho. And of course, if you go to ADS, you get a non-zero rho. But, given the constraints of the current program, rho equals zero is unavoidable. And this strange property is going to control much of the hydrodynamic behavior of the dual fluid we'll see later in the talk. Okay, so we've got this metric here, which is just flat space in a funny coordinate system. And when you look at the Brown-York stress tensor on this constant radius slice, you find it's got arbitrary pressure and arbitrary fluid pore velocity. You can also look at the thermodynamics. So there's a Rindler horizon. If you normalize the Killing field so that it's 1 or minus 1 on sigma C, then you find that the ordinary temperature obeys this relation here. So P is ST is the thermodynamics of the situation. S here is the entropy density, 1 over 4G. Okay, so this describes the equilibrium configuration. Now we want to see if we can go to hydrodynamic solutions describing small fluctuations around this equilibrium configuration.
How am I supposed to interpret physically rho equal to 0? Am I supposed to think that the internal energy of a system is negative?
So the equilibrium energy density of the fluid is 0. We'll see later when we include hydrodynamics, when we look at fluctuations, we'll find that the energy density in the local rest frame can go negative.
Okay.
I'll show you how to interpret this later. Actually, there's a nice way of understanding this by looking at the Hamiltonian constraint of the fluid, which basically plays a role of an equation of state. So at the end of the talk, we'll come back to this question of what does it mean to have a vanishing equilibrium energy density? How can we understand it? What are its consequences? So I'm going to sort of put that on ice just for half an hour. Okay, so now we want to go from equilibrium configurations to describe the hydrodynamic regime. So before, these parameters P and V, these were constants. Now we're going to allow the pressure and velocity to vary. So I'm going to be interested in this particular limit here. We'll see more clearly where this limit comes from in just a few slides. But the essential point is, so there's this parameter epsilon, which I'm taking to be very small. So the thing is, we're going to the limit of small velocities, long wavelengths, long times, or your low frequencies. So this is it's a non-relativistic limit, notice. So time and x, t and x scale differently. And the pressure we're going to take to be just the background value, 1 over root rc, plus some fluctuation p, big P. So the pressure fluctuation is going to scale as epsilon squared. And again, we're going to long wavelengths and long times. So I'll show you more clearly where this limit comes from in just a few slides. It's related to the Navier-Stokes equations.
The x vector doesn't include r, right?
No, that's right. Yeah. So these things are purely functions of the coordinates on the cutoff surface sigma c, which are x and tau. That's right. So the idea is we had an equilibrium solution describing constant pressure and velocity, and that we now allow them to fluctuate.
You just put velocity slowly
on.
That's right.
So velocity is small because it goes as epsilon, and pressure is also small because it goes as epsilon squared. This is a fluctuation around the background value. And the point about this is that if you took a time derivative, it would go as epsilon squared. If you took a space derivative, di acting on this, it would go as epsilon. So basically, by promoting these things in the brackets, epsilon squared and epsilon x, we're meaning that derivatives scale, time derivative scales epsilon squared, space derivative scale as epsilon. Okay, so we just took the equilibrium solution we had. If you plug in this expansion here and expand in epsilon, you get this metric here. So remember, if V and P are constant, this is just flat space expanded up to a certain order. When V and P are not constant, this is no longer flat space. But nonetheless, one can show that it satisfies the vacuum Einstein equations up to order epsilon cubed if one imposes an incompressibility. So V had better be divergence free. Okay, so when P and V are functions of X and T, this is no longer flat space, but it's still a solution of the vacuum Einstein equations up to a certain order, up to epsilon cubed order. Can we extend this to higher order? Let's see what happens if we go to epsilon fourth order. So if you look at epsilon fourth order, you find that this doesn't satisfy the vacuum Einstein equations. It's not Ricci flat. But you can make it Ricci flat by adding an extra term to the metric at third order. But this new term has to contain derivatives of the velocity, as it will turn out. So a term containing derivatives of the velocity and pressure, these can't come from expanding the equilibrium solution, which just contain the velocity and pressure with no gradients. Okay, so coming at this from a very different track, Redberg, Keeler, Lysov, and Strominger basically wrote down the metric to epsilon cubed order, which has the property of satisfying Einstein's equation through to epsilon fourth order, provided the pressure and velocity obey the incompressible Navier-Stokes equations. So if you look at this metric, the first three lines are exactly the same, and then there's this extra term that involves derivatives of the velocity. So these authors derive this metric via different considerations, but from our point of view, we can see that the first three lines are just the seed solution we had before. It's just the equilibrium solution expanded out in this epsilon expansion. But this extra term here doesn't come from expanding out the equilibrium solution. Okay, So in order for this to solve Einstein's equations up to epsilon fourth order, the pressure and velocity have to obey the incompressible Navier-Stokes equations. So let's remind you, the incompressible Navier-Stokes equations look like this. So this is just Newton's second law for a fluid element. So essentially, we've divided out by the density. So this is really the kinematic viscosity, you know, the sheer viscosity per the energy density, and this is really the pressure divided by the energy density. So the acceleration, the convective derivative here is just given by, you know, this is the shear stresses, and this is the forces due to pressure gradients on the fluid. And it's incompressible. Okay, so the interesting thing is, so the question was, where did this scaling limit we had before come from? So actually it comes from the incompressible Navier-Stokes equations. If you look at Navier-Stokes equations, it has this scaling symmetry here. So every term in this equation goes at epsilon cubed under this scaling. You know, if you think of this term here, you know, d tau goes as epsilon squared, v goes as epsilon, so this is epsilon cubed. If you look at, say, this term here, there's two x derivatives, which means it goes as epsilon squared, and there's a velocity, which is also epsilon, so epsilon cubed in total.
It doesn't.
So the scaling is entirely just this. So you can see pressure goes as epsilon squared, and the di pulls down another epsilon, so that term goes as epsilon cubed. Yeah, so in a sense, this scaling generates a one-parameter family of solutions. If you give me one solution by doing this transformation here, I generate a new solution, and you are a one-parameter family of solutions. So you can use this scaling solution to recover the incompressible Navier-Stokes equation starting from essentially any fluid mechanics equation. So if we start from, say, relativistic fluid mechanics, and we apply this epsilon scaling, so we take this hydrodynamic limit where we set this parameter epsilon to zero, and basically the leading terms are epsilon cubed order, and they're just the incompressible Navier-Stokes equations, plus higher derivative corrections, which can be organized according to their scaling in epsilon. So the significance of the incompressible Navier-Stokes equations is that it's describing the universal long wavelength behavior of essentially any fluid. You know, if you do this epsilon scaling, the only terms you can write down epsilon cubed order are basically the Navier-Stokes equation. There are no other terms you can write down epsilon cubed order. You know, you might think you could have, constant V and constant P has to be a solution, right? Because you could, by Galilean invariance, you could boost back to a fluid at rest. So there are no other terms you could write down in this equation. I'm trying to think of whether you could have terms like, yeah, it's a good exercise to go through. There are no extra terms you can write down in this equation. So basically, this is the unique equation epsilon cubed order up to rescalings. Okay, so the point is that we've got this pitch on the fluid side, that if you start with any fluid theory, you can use this hydrodynamic limit to organize the theory. And you can, in the hydrodynamic limit, you can write it down as the incompressible Navier-Stokes equations plus a series of higher derivative corrections, which are organized by this expansion in epsilon. So the idea, to construct the bulk solution now to all orders, we're going to use the same idea. So in the fluid, we've got this hydrodynamic expansion. We're going to use the analogous expansion on the bulk side to construct the bulk geometry as gradient expansion. So remember, this hydrodynamic scaling, spatial derivative scaled as epsilon, time derivative scaled as epsilon squared, and you know the radius doesn't scale, so dr is of order 1. So this gives us a gradient expansion solution scheme to construct the bulk geometry to all orders. So you remember how gradient expansions work in general. If you impose Ricci flatness, this is some partial differential equation, but the point about a gradient expansion is you're imposing a hierarchy between the different derivatives. So that splits a PDE up into a series of coupled ODEs, ordinary differential equations. That's essentially the trick behind what we're doing. It's just a gradient expansion. It's a well-known trick. So let's see how this works in a little bit more detail. Let's imagine we've got a solution up to a certain order in epsilon. Let's say we've got a solution to order epsilon n minus 1. So remember, you know, by starting from that equilibrium configuration expanding in epsilon, we had a solution up to epsilon squared order. So that will be a starting solution, a seed solution for us. So now, I've got a solution up to a certain order. I want to construct a solution to one order higher. So we're going to add a new term to the metric at order epsilon n, which is now the new order. So the Ricci tensor has two components, right? There's a component due to the new part of the metric we added.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So in fact, eta is fixed by the metric, and it'll be one in our system. Yeah. That's right. So we get back Navier-Stokes equation with a fixed value of viscosity. So the bigger story is that the gravitational solution fixes all the transport coefficients and properties of the fluid, so the viscosity and also higher order transport coefficients, as we'll see later. Okay, so I've got a solution to order n minus 1. I now add a new term to the metric and order epsilon to the n. What does a Ricci tensor look like? It's got these two pieces. There's one piece due to the new term we've added in the metric at top order, and then there's a piece due to the metric we had at previous order, evaluated to one order higher. Okay, so it's easy to work out what this new piece in the metric looks like due to the adding the new term in the metric. So we know what this piece is, just an unusual linearized formula.
Sorry, we're just adding the metric on this cutoff surface?
In the bulk. No, this is a bulk metric. Yeah, so yes, right. So the metric on the cutoff slice will always stay fixed throughout the construction, and what we're trying to do is add new terms to the bulk metric to solve the bulk Einstein equations to one order higher. Yeah. So we've added a new term in the metric at leading order, epsilon n order, and we're seeing what does the Ricci tensor look like. So we've got these two components here. There's this linearized piece due to adding this new term in the metric. So because we're adding a new term in the metric at top order, basically in the linearized formula, the only pieces that can contribute are R derivatives. We're not interested in spatial or time derivatives because these would be higher order. So the change, if I had a new piece in the metric at order n, the change in the Ricci tensor due to that new piece in the metric is just given by the usual linearized formula, keeping only the R derivatives. So the idea is that you can solve. So we want to solve Ricci flatness. So we've added a new piece to the metric. This is the change in the Ricci tensor due to the new piece in the metric. And this is what we had from the previous metric at low order, which is known. So we can solve these equations. We can essentially integrate this up to find the new term that we need to add to the metric in terms of the pre-existing metric. Yeah.
So in the ABS construction, but in the black brain solutions, the dependence on R the stuff on the R is constant surface, but the R dependence stays the same. Here you are allowing an R dependence.
I think those two constructions are very analogous. I mean, if we wanted to do the ADS case, we would just add in a cosmological constant term to this equation here. So the R dependence is determined by integrating these equations. So you can see there is an R dependence from integrating this up.
But it's not just the R dependence that was in your boosted solution.
No, it's new R dependence.
There are perturbations due to dependent R. I think that's different than a lot of the ADS.
Yeah, I'd have to look at the details. That's right. Yeah, that's right. So the R dependence is fixed just by integrating this up, and there's present, there's... Yeah, when I get to the final solution scheme, it will be clearer where the R dependence comes from, perhaps. Okay, so we can integrate this up to try and find the new term we need to add to the metric in terms of the known terms at lower order. First of all...
Do you need time to get the neural integration constant?
Yes, we do. Yes, that's right. So we'll see how this works in just a slide or two. Basically, there are new integration constants at every order, but there are also gauge freedoms and freedoms to redefine the fluid variables. And so all these basically combine together. Okay, so in order to be able to integrate up these equations, there are integrability conditions you have to satisfy. I mean, it's easy to see where this one comes from. If you look at here, if we're going to solve these equations here, the variation in the Ricci tensor is given by these two terms here. So those two terms have to match, which is just this integrability condition here. Similarly, if you look at the trace of this equation here, that also involves GII. So basically, there's an integrability condition here. So in order to integrate up these equations, there are two integrability conditions that have to be satisfied. So you've got to ensure that these conditions are satisfied. One of them just comes from the Bianchi identity. So you look at the Bianchi identity, the divergence of the Einstein tensor at this order. So this equation here is just the Bianchi identity, so that's straightforward. This equation here, the Bianchi identity gives you this, so there's a radial derivative here. So if you integrate this up, you get an arbitrary function here of t and x, but not of r. So the integrability conditions requires this arbitrary function to vanish here. So where does this come from? So actually, this comes from conservation of the Brown-York stress tensor. So here's the Brown-York stress tensor here. The definition of the Brown-York stress tensor involves the extrinsic curvature. If you use the Gauss-Kadatze identity, you can relate this combination here to the bulk Ricci tensor contracted with the normal to sigma c. And so the point is that the metric solves the vacuum Einstein equations to order n minus 1. So basically, the Ricci tensor of order is of order n. So this normal is the background normal. So it's easy to work out. So if you plug in the background normal, you get this combination here. So basically, conservation of the Brown-York stress tensor is equivalent to the vanishing of this arbitrary function. So imposing conservation around your stress tensor means that these integrability conditions are satisfied and you can integrate up to find the bulk solution. So to summarize this in words, so this is the point. Conservation around your stress tensor enables you to satisfy the bulk integrability conditions. And from the point of view of the fluid, you know, conservation of Brown-York stress tensor is equal to the Navier-Stokes equations and also the incompressibility conditions. So if you look at, so at epsilon squared order, conservation of Brown-York stress tensor boils down to incompressibility. At epsilon cubed order, conservation of Brown-York stress tensor becomes the Navier-Stokes equations. And if you go to high orders, you get corrections to these equations. So to finish off the integration scheme, we have to specify the gauge we're using, and we have to impose boundary conditions. So a convenient gauge to use is this one here, because it basically, we've got boundary conditions on all the tau and x components of the metric, because we want the induced metric on sigma c to be flat and not change. So it's convenient to impose a gauge that basically sets to zero all the components of the metric we don't know. So that's where this gauge choice comes from. As for boundary conditions, so first of all, we want to preserve the induced metric on sigma c. The only other boundary condition we need is that we're going to impose regularity on the future horizon, H plus. Basically, the solution contains logarithmic terms that would diverge on the future horizon. So to obtain a regular metric, we set these to zero. So that's our second boundary condition.
What about the asterisk?
It doesn't enter.
So you're saying if you impose this, it's also just still the regular asterisk?
No, we would expect it to blow up on the past horizon. I mean, the reason why is that Navier-Stokes equations are damping with, as you go forward in time. So if you run it backwards in time, a solution would blow up as you go towards the past. So if you want to get around this, you could try imposing you could force a fluid at some time. So you start off with a fluid at rest, and then you hit it at a certain time, and that would correspond to having a bulk solution describing Rindler space, and then you join it, you'd have a discontinuity, and you join it to a solution with non-zero velocity. So yes, if you want to try and describe what happens in real physical fluid, you'd have to have a shock wave coming in to set it on. So this is discussed by Strom in his paper. Okay, so this is a summary. So this is the integration scheme. You've given me a metric at lower order. To compute the metric at higher order, what I do is I work out the Ricci tensor due to this lower order metric, and then I do these integrations here, and this gives me the new terms to add to the metric of the next order. So the only arbitrariness remaining after fixing the gauge and after fixing the boundary conditions are these two functions here. And basically, these encode the freedom to redefine the velocity and the pressure of a fluid. So to fix the bulk solution completely, we just need to provide gauge conditions for the fluid to fix these two functions here. So this is fairly standard, this part. So to fix the remaining gauge freedom, we've got to specify gauge conditions for the fluid. To fix this Fi, this vector here, we impose Landau gauge on the fluid, which is this condition here. So this is effectively just a definition of what we mean by the relativistic fluid velocity. This just says that, if you think of this condition in the local rest frame of the fluid, this just says that the momentum density vanishes in the rest frame. So to fix this constant Fi, we impose Landau gauge. To fix F tau, basically we have to fix a definition of what we mean by pressure fluctuation. So we say that we choose F tau so that there are no corrections to the isotropic part of the stress tensor. So effectively we're fixing the pressure fluctuation to be this capital P. So that effectively just defines a pressure. So now we've fixed all gauge freedom and we've got a unique integration scheme for the bulk. And we can start from the solution we have from expanding equilibrium metric. So the machinery is now constructed. We hit it and let it run. So we solved the bulk metric all the way up to epsilon fifth order. In principle, we can go to higher order, but it gets increasingly difficult, of course, because you've got to compute the Ricci tensor at higher and higher orders. The solution works for any dimension. So at epsilon squared order, we had the solution just by expanding the equilibrium metric. Now let's look at what happens at next order, epsilon cubed order. So there's this term here, which was found by Strominger and company. There are also extra terms that they missed. These terms are required in order to impose Landau gauge epsilon cubed order. So this is the complete metric at epsilon cubed order. When one goes to epsilon fourth order, one finds corrections to the time-time component of the metric and the ij component of the metric. When one goes to epsilon fifth order, one gets corrections to the tau I component again. So the structure is actually quite cute. And the reason why is that if you think about this epsilon expansion, all scalars and tensors are basically of even order in epsilon. And any vector quantity you can write down is of odd order in epsilon. If you think of VI, right, that's of order epsilon. You know, V squared VI, that's epsilon cubed order. If you think about all vector quantities there of odd order in epsilon, all scalars and tensors, these appear at even order in epsilon. So this is how the integration scheme works. You know, at odd orders in epsilon, we get corrections to the vector component of the metric tau I, and at even orders in epsilon, we get corrections to the scalar and the tensor parts of the metric. So yeah, there's an interesting quirk, which was that basically the leading order solution turns out to be algebraically special. It has this Petrov type 2 behavior, which means that technically there's a certain combination of vial tensor components that vanishes. But it turns out that basically this doesn't appear to extend to higher orders. So when you go to higher order, the solution isn't algebraically special. I suppose the other thing we should say about the solution is that it's regular. There are no logarithmic terms. Basically, because of the boundary condition we impose.
So you're saying you don't have like vector
functions at higher orders? No. So basically, the metric has this property that it is Petrov type 2 at leading non-trivial order, which is like epsilon 12th order. But when one goes to the next higher order, one finds it's no longer Petrov type 2. The story is actually more complicated because later on, Stromer and company went back to look at Petrov type 1, and in that case it's different. That's a weaker constraint, and there you can, it certainly holds a leading order, and then at higher orders you could plausibly arrange for that to be satisfied. So this is actually sort of the tip of the iceberg, this story here. I'm just mentioning it in passing. So the point is the solution we generate is regular, because basically the Ricci tensor is like a polynomial in the fluid variables, and this integration doesn't produce any terms that diverge on the future horizon r equals 0. So that's another nice property. Okay, so we've got our integration scheme. We've integrated up and we found the bulk solution to arbitrarily high order. We've computed all the way up to epsilon fifth order. It's unique. We've seen that the Navier-Stokes and incompressibility equations emerge by looking at conservation of the Brown-York stress tensor. So if we look at the conservation of the Brown-York stress tensor, you know, we get back. So if we look at even orders in epsilon, we're getting corrections to this equation, the incompressibility equation, because this is a scalar equation. So we've got incompressibility at epsilon cubed order, and at epsilon fourth order, we've got these correction terms here, and there are more correction terms at epsilon sixth order, at all even orders in epsilon. If we look at conservation of the Brown-York stress tensor at odd orders in epsilon, we get back the Navier-Stokes equation and plus corrections, because this is a vector equation. So at epsilon cubed order, we get the only terms we can have, which is the Navier-Stokes equation. And we get, at epsilon fifth order, we get a series of corrections to the Navier-Stokes equations. So these corrections are fixed uniquely by specifying that we're solving vacuum Einstein gravity with the boundary conditions we have. Okay, so that was a bulk solution scheme. Looked a bit hairy, but the outcome is very nice. So all the information for the bulk solution, you know, as far as Navier-Stokes equations and incompressibility are concerned, all this information is coming from the stress tensor. So we got this expression for the Brown-York stress tensor, and it's this quite big, quite long, complicated, ugly expression, and it's based as an expansion in epsilon. What we're going to see is that actually, this expression for the stress tensor comes from an underlying relativistic hydrodynamic expansion. So there's actually an underlying relativistic hydrodynamic expansion. When you expand it in epsilon, you get back our bulk results. And this is nice because this underlying relativistic expansion is really much simpler. There's, in fact, only six coefficients we need to fix, and that fixes the entire messy Brown-York stress tensor we got from our gravity results. And also, this makes sense, right? You know, we'd expect the underlying, if there were an underlying holographic description, it should be relativistic. The other hint we had was that we used the Landau fluid gauge condition, and your Landau gauge, that's a relativistic condition. So the fact that we could impose a relativistic gauge condition also was a hint that there was an underlying relativistic theory. Okay. So in general, you know, relativistic hydrodynamics, your stress tensor would look like this. There's a perfect fluid piece here. Remember, HAB is the metric transverse to the fluid velocity UA. And then there's this dissipative, there's this transverse piece here, which encodes the dissipative corrections to the stress tensor. So you'd expand this in fluid gradients. Now, we're coming back to this strange feature of these fluids with corresponding to vacuum Einstein gravity, which is the vanishing equilibrium energy density. So this is important because this basically changes the form of the hydrodynamic expansion for the fluid. It's quite different to the standard form. So you have to go back to scratch and work out what this expansion looks like. Okay, so let's try and understand this property a little bit better. So we've got our bulk solution, we've computed our bulk stress, we've computed our fluid stress tensor TAB. Let's work out what does the energy density look like in the local rest frame. So we contract T with U twice. This gives us the energy density in the local rest frame, and it looks like this. So this is basically the non-relativistic shear. It's the gradient of the velocity symmetrized. So when the velocity is constant, we get back the fact that the equilibrium energy density vanishes. And in general, when you've got a fluid, a non-equilibrium solution, you find that the energy density in the local rest frame is negative because of this sign here. So this looks pretty curious, but there's actually quite, there's quite a nice way of understanding this, which is to look at the Hamiltonian constraint. So the momentum constraint on sigma c, that was a conservation of the Brown-York stress tensor. The other constraint equation is the Hamiltonian constraint. This basically tells you that k squared is equal to kab kab. When you translate that into the Brown-York stress, because the metric is Ricci flat, so there's no intrinsic Ricci tensor, Ricci scalar. Yes, you know, the Hamiltonian is like r plus k squared plus kk, and because r vanishes, we've just got kk equals k squared. So when you translate that into the Brown-York stress tensor, you get this condition here. So this is exact. This is an exact constraint on what the fluid stress tensor must obey. This is quite unusual. You know, I can't think of, it's not easy to think of fluids that exactly obey this constraint. But the nice thing is that you can think about this as basically an equation of state for the fluid. If you plug in your relativistic decomposition into this exact constraint, you get what's effectively a quadratic equation for the energy density in terms of the pressure and the dissipative part of the stress tensor. So you can think of this as basically a quadratic equation for rho in terms of P and the dissipative part here. You know, there's rho squared here, and then there's linear terms, and then there's constant terms. So there are two solution branches of this quadratic equation. One is that rho equals zero, equilibrium rho equals zero. That was the one we're interested in. There's also another solution branch which corresponds to rho being negative. That's an open question. You know, the meaning of that is an open question right now. But the bottom line is this Hamiltonian constraint plays a role of an equation of states. It fixes the energy density of the solution in terms of the pressure and the dissipative part of the stress tensor. So we can use this equation of state to understand this vanishing equilibrium, you know, to understand why the equilibrium energy density vanishes and why the energy density in the local rest frame is negative. So to do that, let's just think about first order hydrodynamics. So we've got to expand this dissipative part of the stress tensor in gradients, relativistic gradients now, and we're just expanding it to first order in relativistic gradients. So the only term you can write down is this viscous term here. So KAB is the relativistic shear, so it's just, you know, the projection of the symmetrized derivative of the fluid velocity. So normally in hydrodynamics you would have a bulk viscosity term, which would go as the bulk viscosity times the trace of this tensor here. But the point is, You know, trace K is the divergence of the fluid flow. Because the fluid flow is incompressible, basically K is of higher order in gradients. So you know, if you look at the equations of motion of the fluid, you find that the fluid is incompressible up to second order in fluid gradients. So there's no term, you can't have a bulk viscosity term because this would actually be higher order in gradients. So the only term you can write down at first order in hydrodynamics is this term here. If we expand out in our non-relativistic expansion, then we can check that eta is 1, and we get eta over s is 1 over 4 pi. So let's plug this term here into our equation of state, so we can now solve for rho. When we solve for rho, we've...
I thought you were using the...
1 over 4g by death, yeah.
Why is that? I thought at some point you were saying that p is equal to t times s.
That's
and
right, yeah.
T, I thought, had a constant p plus some fluctuation.
So the P equals ST was just an equilibrium thermodynamic relation. So it's just for the equilibrium solution where there are no fluctuations. So in that case, S is the entropy density 1 over 4G, and the P and T are what comes from looking at the solution. You know, so T is the Unruh temperature, and then P is the by looking at the Brown-York stress tensor of the fluid. So that P equals ST was just an equilibrium relation. So now we're going to non-equilibrium, but the entropy density is still 1 over 4G. We're working in units where 16 pi g is 1, so that's where that comes from. Okay, but this is slightly as a sideline. The main point of this slide is I'm trying to show you how we can use the equation of state to understand why we get a negative energy density in the local rest frame. So the point is, at first order in hydrodynamics, there's only one term we could have written down. If we plug this into the equation of state, we can solve this quadratic equation for the energy density. It comes out as being minus the shear squared. And then if you expand this out in epsilon to compare with our earlier expansion, you get back exactly the same result we had before. So basically, the fact that the energy density in the local rest frame is negative is a consequence of the fact that we've got this unusual exact constraint on the fluid stress tensor coming from the Hamiltonian constraint.
Plus your assumptions.
Yes, plus our assumptions that the fluid lives on a flat induced metric and there are certain boundary conditions in the bulk. That's right. So in a sense, this is maybe where all this has a deeper interest from a holographic perspective. We don't know what the dual holographic theory is. We don't even know what the setup or configurations to look at here. If we look at this particular setup here, that implies that the dual theory must have a vanishing equilibrium energy density, which seems quite a scary property. Maybe that's a suggestion that you should look at different setups, different induced metrics and so forth, and see if you can try and find one that has a positive energy density. In ADS, if you repeated all this in ADS, you'd find that the energy density of the fluid was positive and you'd be conformal and so forth. And that's more reassuring. So one reason why I think all this playing around is kind of fun is that it gives you clues. By constructing hydrodynamic solutions, you're finding clues as to the properties of the dual theory. And this can serve as a sanity check of whether your configuration, whether your setup is sensible. And also just to work out what the properties are of this setup. So that's what we're doing here. Okay, so let's just push up to second order in the relativistic hydrodynamic expansion now. So you have to do all this from scratch. Because the equilibrium energy density vanishes, you have to reconstruct your gradient expansion. It's different to the standard result. You can use the same methods to construct the expansion, but it's actually a different calculation. So basically one finds that at second order gradient, there are six terms.
Just a quick question. So your fluid, can it have rotation or not?
Yes, that's right, yes. Yes, it's got shear and vorticity, yeah.
It can have rotation.
Yes, it does. So the shear is this K and the vorticity is this omega here.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's second order gradients, so basically six terms you can write down, and that they're characterized by these transport coefficients, C1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So these are all the terms you can write down on second order gradients that obey the correct properties of being transverse and so forth. So what we do is if we expand this out in epsilon, in this non-relativistic expansion epsilon, and compare with our gravitational results, we can read off what these transport coefficients are. So given the calculation to the order we have it, we can read off four of these six transport coefficients, and we find they're given by this. To get the remaining two transport coefficients, we would have to go to higher order in this non-relativistic expansion. So from the gravitation, so the summary thus far is that we've solved the bulk geometry in this non-relativistic hydrodynamic expansion, but the stress tensor we get actually comes from a much simpler underlying relativistic stress tensor, which has this form here. And you can read off the entire gravitational solution, which is really quite complicated. It's described by a very simple stress tensor with only basically six coefficients, of which we can immediately read off four. So the final part of the talk is I just want to give you a simple toy model to try and understand. So we're also puzzled by this property of a fluid vanishing equilibrium energy density. Can you think of a simple toy model that has this property? So actually, it turns out it's not so hard to construct the simple toy model with this property. Here's how you do it. So first of all, we only want to focus on the non-dissipative part of the stress tensor. We're trying to construct a Lagrangian model, and we're going to try and capture the non-dissipative part of the stress tensor, which is just P, just this pressure with zero equilibrium energy density. If you want to get the dissipative terms, you need to couple the thing into a heat bath. Okay, so can we think of a simple Lagrangian model that has a zero energy density but a non-zero pressure? So basically the answer is yes, we can. Here's the answer. So, consider this action here. So it's just like a scalar field, and look at square root d phi squared. We worked this out completely independently, but it actually turns out that this same action was also proposed by Niash, Ghazal and company, and they call it the Kuskutin model, if I pronounce that correctly. But that was a nice surprise. So this actual same model has also cropped up in the context of dark energy and cosmology. But this is a apparently unrelated connection so far. So if you look at this action here, the field equations just describe potential flow. So you can write the field equations like this, and you can treat this as a fluid velocity given by the gradient of some potential, which is the scalar field phi. So the fluid velocity is given by potential flow, by the gradient of the scalar field. This is the equation of motion, and this quantity x is just d phi squared. So if you look at a stress tensor, so you calculate the stress tensor, and you find it's got the required form. It's just got a pressure given by square root of x, and it's got no energy density. So you might have asked, where did this Lagrangian come from? One simple way to get this Lagrangian would be just to impose, so if you think about starting with some Lagrangian, which is some function of the scalar field and its derivatives, x, if we just impose a constraint that the energy density vanishes, then that actually we can solve. If you impose the energy density vanishes, this is the stress tensor. If you impose that this vanishes, then we can solve for the Lagrangian L up to a constant of integration which can be absorbed into a field redefinition. So actually it's quite simple to get this model. So here's an example of a simple toy model that has non-zero pressure but vanishing equilibrium energy density. So if we want an equilibrium configuration describing a constant pressure in the rest frame of the fluid, then we just have a background where phi is t. The velocity will be d phi. From here, the velocity will be, the I component of the velocity will be di phi, which vanishes. So this will be a fluid in the rest frame with a non-zero pressure. The pressure is non-zero. The pressure is given by root x, which basically is, d phi squared. So you get d by dt. So this has got non-zero pressure but zero velocity. And of course, this breaks Lorentz invariance. But then, of course, any fluid solution breaks Lorentz invariance because you're specifying particular velocity. So if you want to understand small fluctuations around this equilibrium configuration, then we just, we look at this solution here. So we take the equilibrium solution, we add a small fluctuation, and then one can look at the solution, one can go away and solve for what the velocity is and what the pressure fluctuation is in terms of this fluctuation here. So when one does that, one gets the velocity is given by this and the pressure fluctuation is given by this. So this simple scalar field model, basically, it does describe a fluid with the properties we need. A few comments. So one thing is that the action is non-local. If you expand it out, because we've got square root d phi squared, if you expand it around the background value, it's got derivatives to all orders in d phi delta phi squared. So, yeah, in a sense, this makes sense though, because if you think about standard ADS-CFT for a minute, in standard ADS-CFT, the Q of t, on the Q of t side, all the divergences in the ultraviolet are local. And that makes sense because on the bulk side, all the infrared divergences in ADS, on asymptotic ADS spacetime, the infrared divergences are local functions of the boundary data. So the divergences in standard ADS-CFT, they're local on both sides. Whereas if we go to flat space, asymptotically flat space, as we're talking about here, the infrared divergences on the bulk side, these are non-local in the boundary data. And correspondingly, you would expect that the dual quantum field theory should be non-local in the ultraviolet. So in a sense, it probably makes sense that this dual theory is non-local. It's still unitary. So another comment is you can easily add other types of matter, just provided that you take their equilibrium values, their background values, to vanish. Interestingly, we wonder whether there's a connection with a brain action, because square root d phi squared, it looks very much like a brain action. So you can almost works, but not quite. So if you start off with a d plus one-dimensional brain embedded in high-dimensional Minkowski space, in static gauge, the action comes out as being like this, so y is a transverse coordinate to the brain. And you can try and take a tensionless limit. If you think of pushing that t, the trouble is there's a 1 here. We want to get rid of that 1. So if you take a tensionless limit where you send t to 0 but keep ty fixed, then this reduces to this action here. And that's very close to what we wanted. What we had before was this. So there's a sign, there's a sign missing there. So it's not entirely clear if this comes from a brain action. One way to do it would be to embed the brain in a target space with 2 time directions. That will basically flip a sign here.
Is there a sign missing in the square root?
Here? So the model we want.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the point. We want a sign there. And the point was if we start it with embedded in the higher dimensional Minkowski space with only 1 time, then we don't get a sign under there. So that's right. So if we put it in the high dimensional Minkowski space with 2 times, then we would get that sign. But okay.
So just one question again.
Yep.
So if you just use that action, you only get gradient fluid flows because gradient of phi is your fluid velocity.
Yep,
but I guess in your previous picture you said you could have vorticity. So
So the vorticity is connected with dissipative parts of the Lagrangian, the dissipative term. So we're trying to construct the Lagrangian model, which is only going to capture the non-dissipative part of fluid. So it's not going to.
But I guess the thing I'm trying to understand is that at the lowest order level, if you forget about this a bit there,
yeah.
The GR solutions, do they correspond to gradient flows on the fluid side, or they could have rotation on the fluid side as well?
So you were saying, could you have a solution with vorticity but no dissipation? No, we're not capturing all fluid behaviors. That's right. We're only capturing the potential flow behaviors with this model.
You think that you only capture potential?
We're clearly only capturing potential flow with this model. That's right. I don't know. Yeah, that's right. So one could try and adding in a more general.
Okay.
So it's not obvious how to proceed at this point. Yeah.
Is it possible for this model to be expanding by negative
rho? Right. Yeah. So the point was the energy density was zero. Basically, the energy density was negative because of the dissipative parts of the stress tensor.
Okay.
So for the purpose of this model, we're just talking about the non-dissipative parts, stress tensor, of which rho is zero, and that's a property of this model here.
Right.
Yeah.
What
happens to rho in that model? Rho is zero in this model. So we worked out the stress tensor of this model, and it just has a pressure term here. PHAV, and there's no energy density.
But if you had a plus d phi squared, would rho still be zero?
Yeah, probably.
So what was the plus?
Actually, I didn't check that.
What would happen to rho if you calculated it for this model?
We can probably just see it from here, can't we? I think it would still be zero.
It's probably the plus.
I think it's a bit sick because d5 should be a space-like here.
Yes, that's right. So that's the top.
So your velocity
yeah.
is always faster than the speed of light.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So you know, this is why we needed the minus sign here, so the time groups have the kinetic time have positive sign and so forth. So one could either think of this as describing fluid flows that are sort of space-like. So you would be a space-like vector rather than time-like vector. But yes, it looks a bit sick, that's right. So it's not clear the connection to a brain action, at least naively.
I can put an overall minus sign in here.
Sorry, good.
I can put an overall minus sign in here.
Well, we need the minus sign inside the square root, that's the trouble. Yeah. Anyway, it's an open question. Okay, so let's summarize, just finish up now. Okay, so the conclusions were simple. So first of all, we showed that there's a direct relation between the incompressible Navier-Stokes equations and a solution of the vacuum Einstein equations one dimension higher. You give me a solution of the incompressible Navier-Stokes equations along with the specific set of corrections, then I can construct by this procedure a solution of the bulk Einstein equations in vacuum. So the dual fluid has some very interesting properties. You know, because of the Hamiltonian constraint, which you can think of as an equation of state, we find that the fluid has zero equilibrium energy density. But nonetheless, there's an underlying hydrodynamic description which very much simplifies what's going on. And using the bulk gravitational solution, we can identify the transport coefficients in the dual fluid. And we've seen that a simple square root Lagrangian model captures many of the key properties of this dual fluid. Of course, there are many open questions remaining, and I'd like to come back to some of these in future work. So, you know, first of all, is there a relativistic construction? Did we really need to do this non-relativistic epsilon expansion? We probably could have started and just done a purely relativistic expansion scheme for the bulk. And of course, the answer is yes, you can, and it'll appear shortly. But the other thing you might want to add is, you know, what if you add matter to the bulk? What if you add a cosmological constant, de Sitter, anti-de Sitter? You know, the same expansion scheme should work. It'd be simple to work out the new expansion scheme. Of course, this would tie, you know, how does all this tie in with a sort of standard ADS fluid gravity story? Can you extend this correspondence beyond the hydrodynamic regime on the field theory side? Is there some microscopic field theory going on? Can you identify that somehow? On the gravity side, you know, is there a string embedding of all this? Can you get this square root action from brains? Also, how far can we really push flat space holography? You know, is there a holographic description, you know, dictionary relating the bulk, you know, the behavior of the bulk field to the boundary quantities? And I think also, interestingly, there's this idea of local holography. You know, by the equivalence principle, space-time is locally flat. You can set up this description locally in any space-time. And the idea is, could you try and do a local version of holography where you patch together different flat patches to try and recover a global holographic description of the space-time? So these are open questions. Thank you.
So you said on the first question there, there's about to be a manifest relativistic construction that appears. So
of course, there is fluid mystic. Example.
So
yeah.
I guess what I don't quite understand why you guys ended up starting it differently here. I mean,
exactly.
What's the like intuitive feeling for?
Yes, to be honest, it's something of a historical accident. So of course, Strominger's paper, they were interested in this non-relativistic expansion because one way of thinking about this non-relativistic expansion is like it's a near-horizon limit plus an overall vial rescaling. So they were interested in this non-relativistic expansion that goes back to Navier-Stokes because it's related to a near-horizon limit. So in a sense, you know, my starting point for this paper was I wanted to understand their expansion, where it came from, where, you know, was there a systematic way of constructing their solution? Where did it come from? So, because of that, that's why I started trying to construct the gradient expansion using this epsilon expansion. But of course, from a purely holographic perspective, it makes more sense to do a relativistic expansion and recover this relativistic stress tensor, you know, in much less work. And of course, this is what we've now done, and it's possible. And I have the solution I can show you afterwards offline. So.
Do these solutions support gravitational waves?
Yes. So, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, because the fluid, of course, the fluid doesn't have. Oh. No, I think it would.
Well, what's the question?
It's gravity.
Is it gravity?
I mean, let's see.
Can you compute the vial tensor?
Yeah, that's right. So the vial tensor would be non zero in the bulk.
You have a strong condition that the slicing or the slices are flat, right?
It's only flat on one slice, which is I equals RC.
Only one slice.
Yeah, it's not flat on other slices at different radius.
Oh, okay.
So the vial tension of the bulk is non-zero, that's true. So yes, I think you would have gravitational wave.
Yeah, because again, the ABS ones, their solutions are weird, right? Because it's kind of weird because there's no order, right? Yeah, you have the same geometry and every slice. Trivial.
Yes, because the dual theory is conformal, I guess.
That's
right. Yeah, so here, of course, you get a different metric on different radial slices, that's right. Yeah.
It would be interesting to look at whether the gravitational
wave is to descend in a gravitational wave. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so you want to look at entropy currents as well. You know, you want to construct an entropy current for this theory and send in gravitational waves and so forth and see the black hole grow.
I
think we should discuss this afterwards. It's less clear to me. Basically, I think it should be a. I can do it in terms of based on Strominger's work, we can do it in terms of coordinates. The other thing is, I like to think of this near horizon expansion as basically, you rescale the null generators of the horizon. You know, zeta goes to lambda zeta, and n goes to 1/(lambda n). So you should be able to construct this near horizon expansion in terms of expanding, you know, rescaling the null generators of the horizon, and then up to a constant vial transformation that then equivalent to this epsilon expansion we have here. But I mean, this is Strominger's claim. To make this precise, I'd like to make this kind of.
Yeah, let's go.
More precise. Yeah.
When you go to the horizon, what happens to the separation? The grid becomes non-viscous.
As you send RC towards the origin, towards the horizon.
Yeah.
So I suppose we can look at the properties. So eta, according to our definitions, eta is fixed at 1. So we're defining eta via the bulk stress tensor. So the fluid stress tensor, TAB, is like -2 eta times the shear term. So that's our definition of eta. So eta, the viscosity is fixed. And the entropy density is also fixed, so eta rest is fixed.
So the other
transport coefficients do evolve under sending the cutoff in.
But RC doesn't enter the first one.
Sorry?
RC doesn't enter Navier-Stokes?
No, it doesn't, because Navier-Stokes only involves the first order piece in the expansion, the viscosity term, which is fixed. Yeah, right. So basically, the higher derivative corrections to Navier-Stokes equations, so we get back Navier-Stokes equations. There is an RC. That's right. So that comes because of the fact that we're putting on a metric which is -RC d tau squared plus dx squared. So basically, that RC there, it comes from the fact that we're putting on a metric which is -RC d tau squared.
Yeah. So it looks like.
Yeah, you guys would be RC.
So Navier-Stokes equation, this would change as you vary RC. But it's not because, in our perspective, it's not because the viscosity is changing, it's because the metric on which this Navier-Stokes equation lives is changing.
Okay, but effectively the viscosity in Navier-Stokes.
Yes, that's right, yes, that's right.
So it becomes
yes.
Non-viscous.
No, I don't agree with that. So I think from our perspective, the point is that this factor here is due to putting it on a metric which has geometry minus RC dt squared, not just minus dt squared. So basically this RC is because we're putting on a metric. So in our coordinate systems, the metric on which the fluid lives is degenerating as RC goes to zero because it's minus RC d tau squared. So the viscosity, the physical viscosity is just fixed at one.